Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another edition of the Move the Sticks podcast. I'm Rhett Lewis, in for DJ today, alongside my guy, Bucky Brooks. Bucky, what's happening, man? We are working our way further and further away from the 2020 NFL draft, which means we are closer and closer to the 2021 NFL draft. That seems weird to say, doesn't it?
Yeah, but no. That's how I prefer to look at it. Like, look, hey, 2020 is in the rear view right now, right, looking through the windshield, and man, 2021.
You
talk about quarterbacks and excitement and guys and all of that other stuff. Like, we got plenty of time to talk about it this summer, but yeah, man, it looks like it will be very, very easy to keep listeners engaged with the quarterbacks that we'll talk about next season.
Yeah, no question. And I think I speak for just about everyone on planet Earth. We cannot wait to get rid of 2020 as fast as we... This has been one heck of a year, man, and we're still right in the midst of it. But we're going to make the best of it here. And look, it also turns out to be a year in which we unfortunately lose one of the legends, not just of the NFL, but of the game of football, Don Shula, passing away this week, the coach of the Miami Dolphins, who guided them to the only perfect season we've ever seen in NFL history, 17-0 in an NFL title, Super Bowl championship. And the patriarch, Bucky, of the first family of football coaches, both of Don's sons, Dave and Mike, both coached in a Super Bowl. Dave's son, Chris, has coached in a Super Bowl. They've had three generations of Shula coach in a Super Bowl. I mean, this is a family unlike any other that we've seen in the NFL, and we lost a great man and a great coach, and the stories have been pouring in, the tributes have been pouring in. And Bucky, you entered the league and kind of right in the midst of the Don Shula heyday there.
Yeah, what's crazy about it, Rhett, I actually have a game ball somewhere in a garage, maybe at my parents' house, where my first fumble recovery was actually against the Miami Dolphins on special teams. And think back to the Miami Dolphins and Don Shula, and there are three things that come to mind. Excellence, perfect season, most wins of any NFL coach in history. Yeah. I think about consistency, 33 seasons on the sideline, only two losing seasons. So it's one thing to be excellent a little bit of the time, but it's another thing to be consistently in the hunt, always kind of in range to be able to compete for the title. And then the last thing is adaptability. The adaptability that he displayed going from Baltimore, where it was a pounded out system with those players running the ball, Earl Merle, those guys coming to Miami. Then it's the Miami pound machine, Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, Mercury Morris. You had two quarterbacks in Bob Greasy and Herb Merle, being able to have the no-name defense, then moving on to the Killer Bees. When I was I wasn't even a teenager, maybe 10, 11, 12. Yeah. Then changing the style with Dan Marino and those guys and throwing it all over the yard. Good coaches put players over system. And Don Shula was the master of being able to assess the situation and then put in a scheme that enabled his guys to play at his best. So excellence, adaptability, consistency, those things come to mind when I think about Don Shula.
Man, that's a great way to put it. And like, I unfortunately never had a chance to meet Don, but I've met his son Dave, who obviously we know is coached with his dad in Miami through some of the Super Bowls, and then went on to coach the Cincinnati Bengals. Is now the wide receivers coach, I believe, at Dartmouth with Buddy Tevens. So got back into coaching in the last couple of years, and you can see the type of person that Don Shula was by meeting the other members of his family. I think a man that was built for others, that loved to engage others, and was an organizer, was a guy who brought people together. Talking about Dave here, I saw him every summer at the Manning Passing Academy, and I loved being around him. He loved coaching wide receivers. He loved coaching the young kids. I think that's probably why he got back into it. And you know, I think everyone that kind of came through there and had a chance to spend some time with Dave was better for it. And then I had the chance to meet his son, Chris, who, you know, kind of worked his way up, was a graduate assistant, my alma mater at Indiana under Kevin Wilson, and then jumped into the league and ended up being an assistant position coach with the Rams, then worked his way up to a full-time assistant coach now with the Rams as the outside linebackers coach there for Sean McVay. So, look, he's just a you know, it's a family that understands what football is all about, that understands what relationships are all about. And I think that's, that is a credit to their the patriarch of that family and Don. And I think his legacy will obviously go on forever here in the NFL and in NFL circles, and is thought highly of. I don't know anyone who does not think of Don Shula in the highest of regards. So certainly our condolences to his family and thoughts go out to them as they mourn the loss of a great, great man. So with that, guy, let's move it on here on the Mood Sticks podcast here. And one of the bigger news items of the last couple of days was, one, you know, Andy Dalton getting released by the Cincinnati Bengals. Bucky, obviously one move that we expected. A little bit unexpected, though, to see him sign so quickly with a team in which he doesn't have a clear path to the starting job, at least in the near term, it would seem. So two kind of ways you can look at this as a surprise. One, that, wow, the Cowboys went out and got a, you know, an actual, you know, another starting caliber backup quarterback. And then the other piece of it is, well, I wonder, you know, Andy settled, I guess, for that kind of role. Do you look at it that way at all?
No, I don't look at it as that. I think there are a couple of things that are at play with the Dallas Cowboys making this move. So often we view the backup quarterback position and we don't necessarily give it the value that it needs, because a lot of times if the starter goes down, we just kind of throw away the team's chances of being able to compete at a high level. For the Dallas Cowboys, I think this is insurance. This is like insurance on your home. No one wants to pay the premium, but then when the house has a catastrophe, you'd certainly want to cash in on the policy. The Dallas Cowboys were able to get something that you rarely are able to get. That is a backup quarterback who can actually play. Regardless of what you think about Andy Dalton in the last couple years, the fallout for the Cincinnati Bengals kind of collapsing the last 3 years, the first 5 years of his NFL career, he led the Bengals into the playoffs. He had the third most wins of any quarterback during that period, the first 5 years at starting quarterback. And when he is surrounded by a very good supporting cast, Andy Dalton absolutely can win games. When he's not, he just doesn't have the talent to elevate an average squad without playmakers on the outside, and that is fine. I think in this situation, what you have for the Cowboys is insurance against Dak Prescott getting injured, insurance against a long drawn out holdout, or it's not even a holdout, whatever. He just doesn't show up. He doesn't sign and come to camp on time. And you have an opportunity to take a team that on paper looks very, very talented and at least be a very competitive team, a team that can win games in a short-term stretch with Andy Dalton as the quarterback.
Okay, so I should clarify. I meant I wasn't surprised to see the Cowboys make the move, right? Little bit surprised to see Andy go that route. Now, maybe that was the best deal that was out there, and he wanted to sign quickly. He didn't want to drag this out for his family in these uncertain times. Let's get in. Let's go to a let's go back home to the state of Texas, where he grew up in Katy, Texas, and played at TCU. And that
has
part
a house,
right? Yeah, has a house. That part of it makes sense, right? I guess I just thought that he might have an opportunity to go to a place where a starting job was more in his grasp than, like, okay, Dak gets hurt or Dak doesn't come to camp on time. Like, I thought maybe, you know, maybe Jacksonville, you know, with Jay Gruden there, we thought that might be an opportunity, right? So anyway, so that part of it just surprised me from Andy's perspective a little bit. But I guess seeing the way that this is dragged out for guys, like it dragged out for Jameis Winston, still going for Cam Newton, maybe we shouldn't be so surprised.
Yeah, no, I think what Andy did was took the security of, hey, this deal is on the table. Let's take it. Also, let's understand who's coaching Mike McCarthy. If I get a chance to get in there, Mike McCarthy has enough experience and know-how to put me in a situation where I can look good. This could jumpstart the second part of my career as a starting quarterback. We saw what happened with Teddy Bridgewater in New Orleans. Drew Brees goes out for 5 games. Teddy Bridgewater gets a stance, and lo and behold, Teddy Bridgewater gets an opportunity to be a starting quarterback. For Andy Dalton, I think it is a great situation in that vein. Dak Prescott has been durable. He hasn't missed a start. He's been there, but just in case he gets hurt, they have a guy who can go in. And for Andy's standpoint, man, what better way to do it than to play at home? There is stability because I already have a home there. I don't have to worry about like my kids and changing and all of those things. So it is a perfect situation for him to be able to jump in and step in and kind of like make the best of a bad situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right there. So like once you dig in, you can kind of see the reasons why. And so now, you know, the Cowboys, again, this is a great opportunity for them to just kind of continue to stack that quarterback room in the event that they end up needing some of that depth there with Andy Dalton. All right. So let's move on to one of the other big kind of topics these last couple of days, which has been the fifth-year option game, which is due, now overdue, for the members of the 2017 draft class. The deadline was Monday for teams to decide whether they would pick up the fifth-year option for those players, which means the option year 2021, right? So they were drafted in 17. This is the Myles Garrett number one overall year. And then you play that 17, 18, 19, 20 season. The fifth year for all those first round picks is an option for the team to decide whether they want to pick up or decline. That option is then guaranteed for injury only. So if a guy gets hurt and can't continue to play, he's on your books no matter what for 2021 if you end up picking that up. If you don't, they're a free agent, unrestricted free agent in 2021 right after this season. We saw that happen this past year with Jack Conklin and the Titans. They declined to pick up his option after making him a top 10 pick back in 2016. He ends up having a decent year in his fourth year after a couple of down ones following his rookie season, ends up signing a huge deal with the Cleveland Browns. So having a team decline your option is not a death knell. It can, in fact, be a very lucrative windfall for you. In fact, that was the case for Jack Conklin. We've seen that. We've seen other teams decide to extend their first-round players before they even have to worry about picking up the option. Saw that this year with Christian McCaffrey, who was the eighth overall pick, who was extended, and the Panthers then didn't have to worry about picking up or declining the option, which they obviously would have picked up if they didn't have the extension. So let's dig into some of these players here. I mentioned starting at the top, Bucky, Myles Garrett.
Hold on, Red.
Like, yeah, go ahead.
Let's talk about, like, just coming from a scouting community standpoint, the reason why the fifth-year option pickup or the client is a big deal is because in most scouting circles, people say it takes 3 to 4 years to really determine if a player can play. Really 3 years, because 3 years would give you 48 games to be able to look at a player, see how he grows in your system, see if he is being able to be a viable contributor. Meaning the thought is if you tier the first round, meaning in the top 10, the expectation of guys drafted in the top 10, if you have a top 10 grade, you're expected to be a guy that kind of falls loosely in the top 5 or top 10 of your position throughout the league at that position, meaning you should be a high-end player at your respective position as we cross-reference your talents around the league. From 10 to 32, the expectation, you expect those guys to be solid starters and key contributors, meaning they should be on the field 70-75% of the time if they're rotational players, but they should be starters. You expect them to be in starting lineup. You expect them to start making waves and really kind of solidifying themselves as foundational pieces to your franchise. And so when you are making these decisions on the option year, a lot of it is, do we view this player as a foundational piece? Like, we can't live without this player. This player has so much value that we have to keep him as a core player, as part of a nucleus that is eventually going to put us in a position to win championships. And so when teams are making these assessments, when they turn down the opportunity to extend them, in some way, it is a failure. It means either the player didn't work, the system didn't fit the player, it's a misevaluation, but it's an acknowledgement of, hey, we might have got this wrong for a number of circumstances, and instead of extending it, trying to make us right, we're just going to move on and see if we can find another player that can give us what we were looking for at the position.
Yeah, and I'm glad you set the table that way. That's some important perspective to have as you kind of assess some of these guys that were picked up or declined here. And as I mentioned, this is the Myles Garrett draft, number one overall. This was a no-brainer pickup for the Cleveland Browns. You don't pass up on edge rush talent like that. That's why they took him number one overall. And despite what happened at the end of last year, I think all can expect Myles Garrett to return to some sort of dominant edge rushing form, in which he had for the last couple of seasons. That was the no-brainer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now the next four players of that top five, I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Four of the top five players picked in the 2017 NFL draft had their options declined. That means a team, again, for whatever reason, deciding that they wanted to forfeit the opportunity to keep them under control for a fifth year. That's Mitchell Trubisky, who the Bears traded up one spot with the 49ers to select at number two. That's Solomon Thomas with the 49ers there at number three. John Lynch's first pick as a general manager. Leonard Fournette, running back from the Jaguars, who just had a serious roller coaster type career with the Jags. Mm-hmm. And then Corey Davis, which was a bit of a surprise, I think, to a lot of us there, ended up going number five to the Tennessee Titans. So let's start right there with that cluster of players. And then I guess we can kind of roll in for the 49ers. In fact, they came back into the first round and got Reuben Foster there, ended up having to cut him for the off-the-field issues. Redskins picked him up. His options declined also. So just to kind of bring that full circle. But, what sticks out to you there about that top five, Buck?
Man, what sticks out to me about this draft in general is just how all over the place we were when it came to those prospects.
Yeah.
Myles Garrett was a talent, I think most people could agree. Mercurial talent, super explosive athlete, has some production. I would still say, like, he was probably drafted on his athleticism more so than his playing ability because he was such a remarkable athlete and freak athlete at this size, but it worked out. Mitchell Trubisky is a tough one because Mitchell Trubisky has earned Pro Bowl adulation. He's been to a Pro Bowl. He's been selected for that, and people can say it's a fan's vote or whatever. You get that. But I think the tough thing and why he is so closely scrutinized is because the Bears not only moved up to get him, but they bypassed the opportunity to get Deshaun Watson and later Patrick Mahomes.
Oh, by the way, their options were picked up.
Yeah, their options were picked up. And I think the bigger thing is, like, the Pat Mahomes thing, I could see, because I think Pat Mahomes was actually a hard evaluation because he was talented, but he was so, sandlot freestyle in his play that it was kind of hard to see how he was going to play because we hadn't really seen a player that came into the league with a game like that translate and have big-time success. Deshaun Watson was the one for me that was tough because Deshaun Watson, Mitchell Trubisky played in the same conference against the same players. Deshaun Watson not only led his team to conference championships, but he clearly outplayed Mitchell Trubisky and was a better player. And so for the Bears to see something that most of the outside world didn't see, that was tough. And so because of that, he has come under so much scrutiny that the scrutiny may even exceed how bad he may have performed based on expectation. But it's hard for people to look at him and look at Deshaun Watson and Pat Mahomes and say that he is in their same class.
Yeah, that quarterback draft is a tough one for Bears fans to stomach, no question. But again, you were right about the Patrick Mahomes thing. I don't think anyone mocked or talked about the Chiefs flying up from the back of the draft to come up to the 10th spot and take Patrick Mahomes. So, it's tough to say, oh, the Bears could have taken him at two. Well, yeah, they could have, but nobody was considering that.
No one knew.
Right.
In going back, Brett, I'm looking at this thing that I wrote back at the time. So I wrote a thing on all pros, pro bowlers, and red stars. And on that list, there is no Pat Mahomes.
right.
There isn't a Pat. I don't have Pat Mahomes listed as an All-Pro. I don't have him listed as a Pro Bowler, but the two guys I had at the position listed were Deshaun Watson, and I had Mitchell Trubisky at the bottom of that list. I acknowledge, like, hey, it's a huge miss on me. And I think the thing with Pat Mahomes, I have notes from scouts that I talked to, like, man, the talent is immense, but good luck fixing him. Then right. I had other guys saying, man, the talent is crazy, like, whatever, but I wouldn't want to draft him. And so, like, I don't think anybody knew. And a lot of it now is a perfect storm. He went to the right situation with the right coach who was able to tap into his creativity without having to put him on the field early. And then it just worked. And look, he's a fabulous player. And I'm not saying that he couldn't do it in other circumstances.
Sure.
But for us, our imagination didn't allow us to see him as an MVP and Super Bowl winner in 3 years. We just couldn't see that. Like, I mean, anyone who says they could see that he would do all these things, I mean, I challenged them on what they saw, because I don't know how anybody could see it translating like that.
Yeah. I think we could make the argument that Solomon Thomas actually had one of his better years as a pro this last year, in a rotational role, though, for the 49ers. Yes. And that's probably not something that the, for whatever that number is for Solly at the fifth year, probably not worth it. As a rotational player, right?
No, and for a guy that was drafted third overall or whatever, like when you're drafted in that range, you're expected to be a takeover player.
Yeah,
and he hasn't shown the ability to take over. He's been a good player, not a great player. And at that where he was taken, you expect him to be a dominant player, like a transcendent type player. He just hasn't been that. He is coming off a solid year, but if he's still playing as part of a rotation, it's hard to justify paying him what you would have to pay him on a fifth-year option.
Yeah, and again, you know, the 49ers have done pretty well up front since that draft pick. I mean, they had, you know, Eric Armstead and DeForest Buckner at that point. We were kind of surprised. You know, it was like, oh, wow, did they go defensive line for the third straight year? They end up doing it, and it doesn't end up working out. But it's obviously worked out with Nick Bosa this last year, and then perhaps with Javon Kinlaw this coming year. So, the last one here that I want to get to as a singular item of the top five is Leonard Fournette, because it's a little bit of a mystery to me. He was such a dominant college football player when he was healthy, and I think you could kind of say the same in the NFL. Like, when he was healthy and he was right with himself, with the team, with the offense, with the philosophy, It was a good deal for the Jacksonville Jaguars. I mean, they won 10 games his rookie year. He had more than 500-yard games. He had 100-yard game in the playoffs. He was a big part of the offense. He limited the exposure of Blake Bortles. And I mean, the Jags made a run in the playoffs. And that's what the kind of thing you started to expect. And then for whatever reason, he ran sideways with Tom Coughlin and with coaching staff, and he had suspensions, and it's like all this stuff that we didn't talk about a lot leading up to the draft as a possibility. No. Like, is this a red flag character guy? I never heard that leading up to the draft. And so it was a shock to see it.
Yeah, it is a shock to see it. And I think if we go back and we look at his collegiate career, I think you could probably make the argument that his freshman season at LSU might have been his best season in terms of how impactful he was. And because he was a right now star, I mean, you're captivated by the way that he played, the toughness that he played, how he did the dirty work, and all of those things. Like, he looked like a man amongst boys when it came to playing. Like, that freshman year, I'm going back, I'm looking at the numbers. It actually wasn't a freshman year. It was a sophomore
year was his best year. Yeah.
Sophomore year, he went for 1,900 yards. My gosh. Like, he went for 1,950 yards. And then his junior year, he only had 800 and 43 yards. And
he was
hurt. He played 7 games. He was hurt. Durability things came up. And we kind of gave him a bit of a hall pass. But you know what's funny about that, Rhett? we did the same thing with Christian McCaffrey, because Christian McCaffrey's last year was not his best year.
Right.
His sophomore year, he was amazing. Like, that's when he challenged Barry Sanders' record. I think he surpassed his scrimmage yards record or all-purpose yards record at Stanford with the ridiculous season that he had. And then his final season, ankle injury, never quite looked right. But look, he strung it together as a pro. I think the bigger thing is stylistically, the league has continued to shift away from the Leonard Fournette type at running back. And quietly, Leonard Fournette has 76 receptions this year.
Yeah, 76. It's a ton.
Like, but we still have the vision of him being the one-dimensional classic hammerhead running back. And he has caught the ball. He just doesn't look like the Kamaras and McCaffreys in terms of the way that they use him. And so it will be interesting how he plays. I still think he has value, but his value is to a team that plays like the Tennessee Titans, a team that is an old-school, grinded-out, physical football team. He would do well in a situation like San Francisco or Minnesota. I believe he has actually been hindered by the offensive coordinators that the Jacksonville Jaguars have had in place. John DeFilippo was not necessarily a grinded out. He wanted to throw it and run the game through the quarterback,
yeah,
not through the running back. And so it just makes it tough, because I don't know if his talents have been fully utilized, but he also hasn't done himself any favors with his behavior.
So the next kind of group of players that I want to look at are the wide receivers in the top 10.
Ooh.
I think I know I was surprised, one, to see Corey Davis go five. I mean, we hadn't seen him work out at all in the run-up to the draft. He had the injury. So then you had Mike Williams go seven to the Chargers, and he had a little bit of a back injury concern, you know, coming out that last year at Clemson, right? We kind of wondered, you know, might he fall? Chargers end up picking him at seven, and then also picked up his option. He's had some really good years, and it kind of seems like he is still on the upward climb in his NFL career. John Ross, you know, 4.22, I get it. Speed, I get it.
Yeah, I missed on John Ross, and I missed on him because I thought he was a more complete receiver than he has turned out to be. And also, like, he was kind of like behind the eight ball because he had the shoulder injury that he waited until after workouts to worked on. So he's always kind of been behind the eight ball. But he certainly hasn't been what you would expect a top 10 receiver to be. The speed has been there, but he just hasn't made the plays. You thought he would be a bigger, more impactful playmaker, and it just hasn't worked for him. Done it in spurts, but not enough. For Corey Davis, my biggest issue with Corey Davis when he was in the conversation as the number one, Corey Davis played at Western Michigan. And look, he came out of nowhere, had two really good years, those final 2 years there. But in the comparison between Corey Davis and Mike Williams, to me, Mike Williams played against tougher competition and dominated. And I felt like if we switch places and put Mike Williams at Western Michigan, he would put up even greater numbers. We put Corey Davis there, maybe he would do the same thing. And so I had a tough time with that. And then when you think about not being able to work out and those things, I just worried about it. He still has talent. He has flashed. The connection between he and Marcus Mariota just wasn't there. And then this year, AJ Brown just became the alpha. And there's a comfort level with him and Ryan Tannehill, and he just kind of took over. And so you just kind of wonder about Corey Davis. He just hasn't played up to expectation.
Yeah, and just kind of going back and looking at John Ross's career as well. That was going to be my point there on Corey Davis. I mean, we watched AJ Brown just completely take hold of that just, of that number one spot.
Yes.
You know, and,
yeah,
which is strange, you know, to see for a number five overall pick to sit there and kind of let that happen. But that's the way it is. And so now Corey Davis will be an unrestricted free agent following the 2020 season. So on John Ross here, you know, he broke out in a big way, and we kind of forget that week one this past season, 7 balls, 158 yards, and 2 touchdowns. You're like, oh, here we go. Here comes John Ross. Next week, 4 catches, 112, and a touchdown. You're like, all right, you know, here we go. This is the John Ross that we thought we were going to, and then just, you know, nothing. He gets hurt, misses 10 games, or 9 games, and then, you know, kind of almost never really heard from again. So, you know, that's kind of been the MO for John Ross, and that's a big reason why he does not have his option picked up. And so we get half of the top 10 having their options declined, and you set the table for us at the beginning. Like, those top 10 players are franchise-building players. They are franchise-changing players. They're players you count on to reach your goals, and that's clearly not the case for half of the players in the top 10 of the 2017 NFL Draft. I want to single out a couple more here, and then we'll get out of here. The one that has been interesting to me kind of since his career began, because we had him mocked sometimes up at number 2 with the 49ers before they traded out of that. I'm talking about Malik Hooker, the safety from Ohio State. He had the injury. Yes. He had the groin, the labrum, the hip that I think precipitated his fall to number 14 in the or 15 in the Indianapolis Colts that year. They, by the way, have declined his option, and he was hurt again. I think he had an ACL his second year. So his career started with injury. It's continued that way, and I don't know that maybe that has played into his inability to impact that franchise, Bucky, but clearly they have seen that they are perhaps preparing to move on.
Yeah, no, and it's weird because, man, he was such a talented athlete. Even when we had Urban Meyer come on last year, he talked about Malik Hooker's basketball background and how explosive of an athlete he was. And when you watched him at Ohio State, he had natural ball skills and just picked it up really, really quickly. And when I look at what he's been able to do for the Colts, he has 7 interceptions in his career. He has gotten his hands on balls. He has been active and around it. He just hasn't been available. That 2017, he missed most of the year. He's missed a handful of games in the following seasons, and you just haven't necessarily seen it. That said, the talent is there. And if the light comes on, like, you can just see how he could be a really good player. It just, for whatever reason, hasn't fully come on. But the dude is talented and certainly worthy of being picked where he was picked. He just, man, for whatever reason, like, it just hasn't worked. And it's really unexplainable.
Yeah, and it was part of some trade kind of scuttle around the draft. Might they be trying to move on from him beforehand, you know, before this season. I also, you know, I don't know that this draft gets the credit, but, man, really good cornerback draft. Marshawn Lattimore at 11 had his option picked up. Dory Jackson's been a really good player for the Titans at 18. He had his option picked up. You go all the way down to Tre'Davious White, you know, arguably the best corner
solid
in the class at 27,
super
right?
Super solid. Picked up. Loved him coming out. Yeah.
No question. And then, you know, I think Garian Conley, for a variety of reasons, you know, it was kind of bringing up the rear in that group. Had his option declined by the Texans after they traded for him last October. You know what the surprise to me of this whole deal was? The tight end, both of the first round, or two, all of the tight ends, I should say, in the first round of this draft had their options picked up. I think no shock to see the Giants pick up on Evan Ingram, but the Bucs picked up O.J. Howard, and the Browns picked up David Njoku, especially for the Browns after signing Austin Hooper to that big contract. I thought those two particular, Bucks picking up Howard and Browns picking up Njoku, were a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I think they were a bit of a surprise based on the conversation that had come out of those buildings, or alleged conversation that come out of those buildings about those guys being kind of underachievers based on what we thought they would be coming into the league. But the teams picking up the options speaks volumes about how those teams viewed him. I think in O.J. Howard's case, he kind of has been viewed as expendable because of the Rob Gronkowski thing. And I would contend that maybe Rob Gronkowski is kind of like the designated hitter in that lineup, where he's going to kind of come in and out of the lineup in stretches, not be a full-time player for the Bucks. And O.J. Howard will have an opportunity to be the O.J. Howard that we thought that he could be. And David Njoku, there's no doubt that he's talented. And it'd be interesting to see how they pair him up with Hooper. Both guys have similar skill sets, but we have seen Kevin Stefanski and the Kubiak system utilize tight ends effectively. So we'll see what they can come up with in their 12 personnel package. And then Evan Ingram, hamstrung a little bit playing with a younger quarterback a season ago, but now he should be ready to rock. And when I think about this offense and the weapons that they have, he should be a primary option in the pass game. They should really try build it around him, because his ability to control the middle of the field, it's shown in flashes. I would think that he would be a very, very key part of the rebuild that Joe Judge is doing in New York.
I mean, arguably a number one receiver in New York. I mean, not even really arguably. Yes. I mean, he's kind of been their most talented guy and could be their number one target for Daniel Jones in his second season. Let's see. You know, I think you could make the argument, maybe not even an argument here, but TJ Watt at 30 to the Steelers and Ryan Ramczyk at 32 to the Saints warranted first round selections. I mean, warranted top 10 selections in this draft when you go back and look at it. Hindsight's obviously 2020, but those were terrific value picks at the bottom of the round.
Yeah, terrific value picks. And, you know, it's one of those things, Red, like when we talk about it all the time on Path, those guys don't get enough credit. Like sometimes, like those picks aren't viewed as sexy picks, but they end up being the best ones. TJ Watt, I remember the challenge was it all kind of came together for him his last season. The production jumped out. You saw him make plays, but you just wondered, it took a long time for him to pop as a college player, and why. And would you get that same kind of production as a pro? The great thing for him, I feel like he went to the perfect spot, because Pittsburgh has always had a knack for being able to find 3-4 edge rushers, and they put him in positions to grow. Ryan Ramczyk was a bit of a surprise, and maybe because he wasn't the athlete, and maybe some of it might have been the Wisconsin O-line thing,
sure,
where you wonder, hey, is it really him, or do they get coached up? Do they have any more upside? Had they been maxed out? Because Wisconsin's coaches do a great job of like really developing their guys to that point. And I think sometimes Iowa offensive linemen kind of get the same pushback, where they're kind of maxed out, because those staffs have done everything in their power to squeeze out all of the juice out of the player. And so maybe he didn't get his just due when it came to his ability to be a longtime starter and a really, really good player for the Saints.
Yeah, and I should go back, by the way, because I skipped over Marlon Humphrey at 16, who's been a terrific player for the Ravens. That was a really, really good cornerback draft.
How about that?
I mean,
like, how about that class? Yeah, Humphrey, Tre'Davious White, Adoree Jackson has been good, particularly as a returner.
Marshawn Lattimore.
All of those guys hit. What are the common denominators? Like, looking at those traits,
yeah,
it would be interesting to see what is the common denominator. Like, right out the gate, the first thing that stands out to me, I think Marshawn Lattimore and Adoree Jackson were very talented track athletes, very athletic. Marlon Humphrey and Tre'Davious White were very skilled technicians. Their technique kind of stood out, and maybe it's a mix. Great athletes, great technicians, those guys play. I do wonder, but it'd be a fascinating deep dive into that first round. And the hows and whys.
Yeah, and just the one guy we didn't talk about in the top 10, Jamal Adams. I mean, I think that was a no-brainer. He's been a culture changer, it seems, on that defense in New York as a safety from LSU. Remember we interviewed him and Tre'Davious White, I believe, together on Path to the Draft. And I mean, that was quite a talented secondary that year for LSU. Any of these other ones that stick out to you? I mean, you got there was a trio back to back to back at 20, 21, and 22. The Broncos declining Garrett Bowles, the Lions declining Jared Davis, the linebacker, and the Dolphins declining Charles Harris, the linebacker from Missouri that year. I mean, gosh, I mean, Harris, you mean barely heard of him down there in Miami?
Yeah, he never really got a chance to really do anything.
Yeah,
you know, never really got a chance to show.
And I should say the Falcons actually opted not to pick him up. They ended up trading for Charles Harris, so maybe they see something in him. But so it was their option to pick up, and the Falcons decided to decline it.
Yeah, I mean, and they just don't have enough experience with him to know who he is and what he can be.
Sure, that makes sense.
You know, but it's definitely interesting to kind of watch it play out.
Yeah, so let's see. And that pretty much covers it. Taco Charlton, I think we all kind of thought was a little bit of a reach at 28, maybe more of a second-round player, ends up getting released by the Cowboys, waived by the Dolphins, and now the Chiefs have signed Taco Charlton, but his option was voided, so... he didn't have an option to be picked up or declined. And then I think that's pretty much most of the highlights from that one. Anything else that you want to dig into here before we say goodbye?
No. I think it's a fascinating study. I think everyone who loves the scouting game and scouting business should go back and look at that 2017 class, that 2017 first round, and just kind of figure out some of those lessons.
Yeah, that's what we did that last day of Path to the Draft, the lessons we learned from this year's draft and what we saw. Again, Bucky wrote about that in his Scouts Notebook, NFL.com/Scout Notebook there for Bucky Brooks to you check out some of those lessons he learned from this one and see how they help us as we try to predict the 2021 NFL draft in some 300 days or so. But Bucky, good to hang out with you, my man. Again, we'll get Daniel Jeremiah back out here. He's just taking a little time to decompress, take a little break, and he'll be back next week to dive into to all things Move the Stick. So again, for DJ, I'm Rhett Lewis. Thanks so much for hanging out with us here. You're listening to the Move the Sticks podcast.